from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. To debug something usually means solving something technical, working out the glitches in some computer software program. But to Raj Jayadev and his colleagues at Silicon Valley Debug, the term takes on a much different meaning. They want to fix the criminal justice system, reform immigration, and empower the powerless. They don't want to debug software. They want to debug society. In the hour ahead, we'll talk to Raj Jayadev as part of our first-person interview series, where we profile the leaders, innovators, and unique individuals from across the Bay Area. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 12 years ago, Raj Jayadev was working as a temp on the assembly line at Hewlett-Packard. His workplace may have been a sometime Silicon Valley icon, but his paycheck wasn't so lofty, and he penned a piece about what it was like for his fellow workers to support families on $8 an hour. Those early writings turned into a magazine, which in turn became Silicon Valley Debug, a group that combines advocacy journalism with community activism. Over the past dozen years, it's taken on the criminal justice system, challenged immigration policy, incubated new businesses, all using a unique combination of media savvy, social entrepreneurship, and 60s-style organizing. The goal of Silicon Valley Debug is to weed out the glitches in our social contract, to debug society by giving people who haven't had a voice in the place they call home. Raj Jayadev joins us this hour as part of our first-person interview series where we profile the leaders and innovators from around the Bay Area. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on our program. So let me just ask you some things about Silicon Valley Debug. So it's journalism, right? You produce magazine, yes?
Yes.
You are a business incubator. There's everything from a design and print business to T-shirt making, yeah?
Correct.
You provide training on media, among other things.
Right.
Tackle social justice campaigns like immigration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Advocacy for criminal defendants.
Absolutely.
You once started a catering company, is that right?
Yeah, one of our folks.
And a meditation workshop.
That's still going on.
All right. So where do you work?
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I think In one way, I'd say I work in that space of where individuals have these hopes and dreams and where they make those hopes and dreams realities. And so there's a common denominator at Debug that makes a rationale for us from the inside looking out. From the outside looking in, it looks pretty dispersed and disconnected. But our common denominator is we believe essentially in the Silicon Valley dream, that we're located in a place where if someone has the audacity to have a hope and dream and an aspiration, are willing to define themselves with their own terms, you could find a community that will support you to make that possible.
So you're a startup.
We're a startup, yeah.
And what supports those dreams? How is it that you can take this disparate series of tasks and goals from community organizing to community media to tackling something like immigration? How do you make it all work? What supports Silicon Valley Debug?
Well, we're a relationship-based group. You know, I define ourselves probably more as a family than an organization, in the sense that literally, you know, we're sort of raising each other's kids now. We're friends. We're at each other's homes. But it also means that we're together in difficult times and need to offer each other solace and comfort. We're there together when we need a little bit of daring and courage to prompt someone to take an adventurous step towards their future that they didn't think was possible. We're also there to protect each other in times of need. So we are really probably more of a belief system than anything else. We believe in the capacity of greatness of everyday people, regardless of what you've been defined at, as labeled as limited to. And we essentially say if you come into our circle, come into our space, you lead us, and you're going to have a movement behind you that's going to try to make that possible.
And what makes it possible just financially? Is there something that you can commodify, monetize? Is it foundation supported? How do you make it all work just so that people who work at Silicon Valley Debug can make a living?
Well, we're foundation-based, grant-based, but also entrepreneurial, so we have earned income. And I think maybe even more so, the reason why we're able to be sort of expansive is a lot of the folks that make up Debug are volunteers. They're mothers that come on the weekends to help contribute and to lead meetings, or they're artists that have a day job but really see themselves as an artist or a TV producer, and so they come in after that. So it's really an organic process that isn't defined necessarily only by the dollars and cents.
So tell me how it works each day, because from that laundry list that I read, it's like you could be walking to work thinking you're an editor. You could be walking to work thinking you're a business executive. You could be walking to work thinking you're a social community organizer tackling the judicial system.
Right.
How does it – when you walk in, let's say later this morning, what do you do?
You know, when I walk in, I usually think I'm likely going to be doing at least two things. I'm going to be trying to put out a fire, a crisis, and probably trying to start a fire in some way. So when we walk in, it really is looking through very different prisms, and it takes a shift of perspective and a shift of brain to some degree. But I think what makes it work is that we really are a flat organization. We really are a type of model which is about everyone carrying their load and then also leading us in various directions. And so for me, you know, I do a lot more now these days around the criminal justice work and the campaigns. That means that I'm not necessarily leading the efforts around the art. I'm not leading the effort around the studio and the music. The folks that do the music lead that. And so the synergy comes in everyone knowing their role on the court, so to speak.
Let's talk about then the area that you're focusing on right now, which is fascinating, the work that you're trying to do within the criminal justice system. First, describe the problem that you wanted to address about who wasn't being represented in the way that you thought was needed.
Yeah, well, I think what we sort of fell into was really looking at the glaring blind spot, maybe the abyss, in the discussion around criminal justice reform. And we are in no doubt categorically in a crisis when it comes to mass incarceration. That term used to be an activist term or an advocacy term. With, say, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, with the data that has come out that says 1 out of 100 in this country is incarcerated in some form, those are issues that are not just progressive issues or localized community issues. That is a national crisis. And what we found was that there was this arena that wasn't really being discussed, and that was the right to adequate counsel. And from our vantage point, if there is an area that could use some dramatic shifts, that could dramatically change those numbers and that term and that direction, is about making sure that communities have an adequate right to counsel. What that meant for us was something very simple and instinctual, I guess, which is fundamentally we're community organizers. We believe that people are stronger together than they are alone. And that's not our invention. It's a legacy that arrives at us in every different walk of life. So there is a basic concept that in public life, communities that feel they need to change over public agencies get together, the most affected, their loved ones, and they influence their power on those institutions. You look at school reform, you look at healthcare reform, even potholes when they need to be fixed. And it's a neighborhood issue. But when it comes to how someone is treated in the court process, how their rights are respected, what sense of agency they have, that had been separated from that community organizing ethic. And so what we did was try to bring a community organizing ethic to the court process. What that meant was individuals who were facing charges, mostly, you know, over 90% of people are represented by a court-appointed attorney in this country when they're facing charges. That's a public agency, which means they could be held accountable. Those people were going in feeling alone and isolated against an extremely resourced and powerful institution, which is the criminal court system. What we could do is change the odds of that, which is by tapping into that person's ability to have impact, their loved ones, their communities, their organizations, their unions, and that we could either, one, hold the attorney accountable to make sure the person we care about is receiving an adequate defense, or two, more aspirationally, partner with that attorney so that attorney also doesn't feel isolated, alone, and outgunned when they go to court. And that's what we've been able to have impact in cases.
What's interesting to me is that your approach to this, and we'll listen to an example in just a moment, wasn't to say or organize to try to increase the number of public defenders necessarily, to increase the number of lawyers in the system, or to get more people to take on these cases. Your fundamental belief was not so much that we need more lawyers to bring about justice, as it was we need to provide the justice system with more information, more data, more stories about who these people are who are being charged.
Absolutely. Our approach was really putting a turn on who was the agent of change. And look, the system has had plenty of years and times to figure this out. They tried investing in judges. They tried investing in lawyers. But perhaps the one agent, the one actor in the courtroom that hadn't been given a chance to really affect the case was the person faced with the charge and their loved ones. If we could animate what I feel is a real already built community organizing infrastructure with those people and their loved ones, we change the equation, and that helps public defenders' offices. It helps balance the scales. It can resource them, even on an office level, when it comes to times when they need to advocate for budgets, for resources, to get experts, to make sure that their caseloads aren't overextended. That's a political question. It's not a legal question. And political power is with the people that are impacted by the issue.
So let's take a listen to an example of what you did in this arena, which is to basically tell a story and to put out there an expression of that person's life. And the example we're going to listen to first has to do with someone who was in long-term incarceration because of the three strikes law. Once the three strikes law was amended to say if you've been in a certain amount of time, you have a chance of getting out, you put together a video to support this individual, which was basically profiling the daughter of this person, a woman named Angela Burt, who has her own remarkable story. She's someone who wound up went a scholarship to go to a private school, did very well, went on to college, is now the director of diversity at that private school. But tell us a little bit more of the story, and then we'll pick up on hearing Angela talk about her dad.
Sure. So a public defender came to us, and it was after we gave a presentation to all the lawyers of their office saying, look, we have this new tool that we think you could use. And we call them social biography videos. And to me, they are kind of called the character letters 2.0'd. And he said, I have a case. We think the district attorney's office may challenge it. They've challenged similar fact patterns with other cases. But he has this great family, and it dramatically increases his odds of not recidivating. And if we could help tell that story, I think we could change their direction here. And so we made a video that profiled his daughter and really the relationship, that he was still a father to his daughter despite the prison walls. And secondly, was giving him advice. But then thirdly, was that she was going to be a reentry system. She was going to help navigate him. He wasn't going to be alone. He was going to be resourced. And if we could add a new point of reference, a new piece of information when they're making their determination, maybe they would decide that he needs to be out in the community and could prosper. So we made this video.
So let's listen to a little bit of this. This is Angela Burt talking about her father, who was sentenced to 32 years in prison for a third strike offense for carrying a weapon. Angela, at the time this was recorded, was 27 years old. Her dad had been in prison since she was 9. And this is a little bit of her talking about her father.
So right now he is 54, going on 55. I accepted that he had to do time. I accepted that a long time ago. When you asked me the question about, like, how have I noticed that my dad has changed, I knew after 10 years, like, wow, my dad really has changed. When I think of a prison, I do think that for certain individuals, it corrects them. it's a time of reflection for them to think about the things in which they have done to get them in that situation. And I think that he learned that a long time ago. I don't think he's angry anymore. At first, it was kind of confusing because I could tell he was really mad at his situation for the mistakes that he made, and he was in the, you know, in prison. And over time, he didn't accuse anyone. He just kind of took ownership. So our conversations would change from these people did this to me, or the system did this to I made these mistakes and this is why I'm here. Like, it's not your fault. And he didn't sound angry anymore. So I would say that's how he changed the most. He just took ownership of what he did.
An excerpt from a video produced by Silicon Valley Debug. So tell us what happened. That video was produced, and what role did it play, and what happened then to Angela's father?
So that video was produced, and it was given to the public defender as part of his presentation to the DISC Attorney's Three Strikes panel, which is a team of high-level prosecutors that make a determination on whether they're going to challenge a resentence or not under Proposition 36. And so they reviewed the video. Watched it, I believe, on YouTube, made a decision that they were not going to challenge resentencing as a result of knowing this new piece of information and actually being able to see his family and hear the sentiment in the motion. He was released shortly after, in a week. And I had the public defender call me and had the good fortune of driving up with him. We had had his first restaurant outing in 18 years, where I brought my laptop and he got to sit down and watch a video of his daughter paying a tribute to him that wasn't only just about a nice story or emotion, but was a tangible piece of work where stories resulted in his freedom.
How's he doing?
He's doing good. He's making the transition, as most of these Prop 36 releases are. The recidivism rate is extremely low in their cases, partly is because they spent so much time in prison, they've sort of aged out of some of the danger zones. But secondly, it could be that a higher premium on what freedom means. I think it really showed that the California voters went the right direction and perhaps need to do more of such reforms.
Raj Jayadev is our guest. He is the founder and executive director of Silicon Valley Debug. Among the many things they do are produce these sorts of videos that can be used in criminal cases. There's so many interesting issues that this raises that I want to ask you about. First, part of the power of that video is Angela herself. She is such a strong character, and obviously is someone who is doing so well. And she speaks very directly to her father's experience, that he was angry, pointing the finger at other people, and then in time pointed the finger back at himself and took responsibility for it. Makes a bunch of different points. But here's the question. How do you know that? Do you just have to trust in the person you're profiling, that really is the truth? Because you can easily imagine, Raj, that you could do an interview with someone who would say, yeah, my dad's great, and it wouldn't be true. And that you, in a sense, would then be an agent of injustice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when we've been asked the question, because we've been having preliminary conversations with public defender offices from all over, really, not just locally. And they ask the question, how do you choose which video to do, or when do you exhaust these resources? And for us, it's not really we're not making a determination on innocent or guilt, innocent or guilty. You know, what we're really trying to do is give a fuller picture of an individual. We're trying to give new points of references for someone that's making a calculus on someone's life. Have as much information as you can to make that decision. And they're going to make a call on the veracity of who they're seeing. What it is, it's new. It's an innovation for sure. But in some ways, it's also very embedded into the court process of mitigation, where they have to make that same decision when they're reading a letter. Mm-hmm. And they say, is this mom telling the truth or is she biased? I think in some regard, our venue or our vehicle of video allows the truth to be even clearer, because you're seeing this person's face. You're in a lot of our videos, what we're doing is bringing the person into their home, into their workplace. We're giving them a 360 view by different characters. So you could see the truth, I think, more clearly through video than I think what we'd been limited to before, which was really just letters.
It's an interesting point, but I guess I would also come back at you and say, video can be so easily manipulated.
Sure.
Everything can be edited. Everything, you insert the right kind of emotional music, it adds a different emotional texture and layer to it. You can take a guy who might not necessarily be the world's greatest dad, but and show him, you know, he's actually making breakfast for his kids. Well, maybe he did that one day, but does he do it, you know, the other 6 days of the week?
Yeah.
There are lots of tricks that you can use that can have a particular effect. Not suggesting for a moment that you do that. But if I'm a DA somewhere, or a public defender rather, how do I know? How do I know that that video is the equivalent of a letter from, you know, a kid sister or whoever?
Well, you know, two interesting things happen in the process of the construction of a video. One is it necessitates a relationship with the public defender. So in sort of a wink and a nod, we've accomplished one goal, which is we've got the attorney to know the or at least investigate the Fuller story. So that's sort of the one of the victories. The second thing is that it's allowing more of the family to invest time to tell that story. And so that is really where we think the bigger game is if we could get family some story somehow included into the process. Mm-hmm. So someone's not defined solely by the charge on the police file, we think we're doing our job.
It puts a lot of responsibility, though, on you as in this case as a journalist, as an editor, in essence,
yeah,
to make a judgment about what's fair and what's accurate, to know whether or not you can trust the story that you're being told.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and are there times when you say, you know what, we're not going to tell your story?
Yeah. Well, we to answer the last question, we haven't yet. And we maybe it's because we haven't been given the right test case. Don't take that as a challenge to anyone. But you know, our role is to amplify voice, and we're not in a position to judge. We're not in a position to advocate certain aspects of a. You know, we're not trying the case. None of us are lawyers or have any aspiration to be. If anything, I think it puts the onus back on the attorney to really quarterback the process of the video construction. So rather than saying, "Hey, you want to make a nice glitzy video," or the family wants to make one, sure, I'll pop in that CD or I'll give it to the DA. But if the public defender is really invested in the best defense, they want to make sure that those statements are not challengeable, that their characters are reliable, that some DA is not going to pull up some case file on someone in the video. And so I think it makes the public defender have to be a better quarterback when developing the strategy.
And is it your feeling in the end that video is just one more tool and that it can be used for a purpose to advocate, that it needn't be, on the one hand, on the other hand, sort of, you know, traditional journalism, that it's an arrow you can pull out of your quiver that can be aimed at the judicial system in this case to make it more equitable?
Yeah. You know, all media forms, for us at least, and I mean, I'm not really sure if we're journalists or not, to be honest, but it's about getting as close proximity to the truth as possible. And video, perhaps more than any other medium recently, allows us to do that in a multidimensional way that I think will be useful for something antiquated like the courts.
Raj Jayadev, our guest, founder and executive director of Silicon Valley Debug. We have to take a short break. When we return, we'll take your questions for him and for the work that he is doing to bring about change in the South Bay. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website. Back with more in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Raj Jayadev. He's part of our first-person series where we profile the leaders and innovators who make the Bay Area unique. His organization is Silicon Valley Debug, which does everything from produce videos to be used in criminal justice cases to producing magazines, TV, and radio. It's a business incubator. It is many, many things. And he joins us this hour, and we would welcome your participating in our conversation, too. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. I want to go back to how this all started. As I said in the intro, this began when you were working on the assembly line at HP a dozen years ago, and you produced a kind of back of hip pocket magazine, which described sort of life in Silicon Valley for temp workers, among other things. Tell us that story. What took place? What jump-started it? What made you think that this was something that you could then nurture into the organization that it's become?
Well, a lot of kind of the philosophical underpinnings of our organization started from the assembly lines and shop floors. I remember where I was working at Hewlett-Packard, we were getting shorted on checks. And it wasn't a big check to begin with. There were temp workers. And people were doing the right things. They were individually going to human resources and saying, hey, I worked more hours than I was getting paid. And no one was doing anything about it. And so there was a petition that erupted in this plant. And people were signing it. And what I did was I watched who signed it and who didn't. And, you know, the first person I went to was this elder woman who was grown up in the Central Valley. She signed it, and I sort of asked her, you know, her reasoning for it. And she said, well, I marched in the fields with Cesar Chavez. I know this stuff works. And the same was true with an older African-American who recounted this story of the Civil Rights era. And also someone from a southern state in India, Kerala, which has a rich history in community organizing. But when it went to the young people, who I assumed would be the first to sign it, they're the ones always talking about the boss and stuff. They didn't sign it. And I asked them why. And they said, oh, this stuff doesn't work. And I was like, well, what are you going to do? They're like, oh, I'm just going to leave here by myself. And it was a real eye-opening moment for me, because what I realized was that the notion of collective voice or the idea of collective action required a personal lived experience that had to make it true. And Debug, to some degree, all these 12 years, has been trying to create these points of references in people's lives. So the next time they're given an opportunity to say, well, I partner with others to do something that otherwise seems improbable or impossible, they're going to know it's possible and they're going to do it.
And do you feel that that ethos that you describe from marching with Cesar Chavez or the civil rights movement, we just experienced the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, that sort of collective action can still be something that guides, that persuades those young people who didn't want to sign the petition to get in the game?
Absolutely. And I think now, say with the people that have grown up through Debug, that's their point of reference. And it's not necessarily something as grandiose as a historical civil rights movement, or, you know, there's one of these icons like Cesar Chavez there or Martin Luther King. But what they do know is that they were otherwise on their own. They found camaraderie and community in the collective. They whispered their dreams. And then a lot of those dreams were made realized through the notion of the collective. And that's something that they'll be able to have with them for the rest of their lives and hopefully try to sort of proselytize too moving forward.
How do you view other activists, organizations, whether that's not organizations, I guess, activist efforts, the Occupy movement, for example, and also kind of the dark side of this sometimes? Oakland, for example, is a city that's struggled immensely with how it contends with protest. Be curious to hear what you think of that, because at least in Oakland, to some extent, some of those people engaged in some activity haven't exactly necessarily been motivated by the same things that motivate you, or at least so it appears. It would appear that sometimes they're just people who want to, you know, make a mess.
Yeah, you know, we've never actually defined ourselves as an activist organization. I think maybe because there's a lot of different hang-ups on what that term means. And in some ways, traditional activism or organizing never fully resonated with us. You know, as an organizer, you get trained that you lead the masses from point A to point B, which never really felt like it fully respected the thinking capacity of everyday people. What I liked about media, or our version of media and journalism, was it allowed people who are in issue to define what their point B was, and that we would collectively go to that point B. And that's very different. It's unpredictable. It's more curiosity based. It's probably less agenda based. Fundamentally, I think where we're in agreement, and we're certainly in agreement with Occupy, and we've been sort of connected to what we could of that movement locally, is this notion of power. And that the only way you're going to get institutions to respond and to resonate to what your demands are isn't by only telling a cute story. It's by something quantifiable. It's about something undeniable. And sometimes you need to flex that power. And certainly that's what we've been seeing and doing in San Jose. And that's what we respect about other movements, say, in Oakland and other areas, too.
But what would you say about – do you have a responsibility, do you think, to sort of police, for lack of a better word, the bad apples in any activist movement to say that's not the way to go about doing business? That's only making life in Oakland harder.
Well, I think it's usually pretty apparent, at least from the inside. When you're in one of these marches, when you're in one of these protests, it's pretty clear who's there for the right reasons. And it's pretty clear who's there for a message of integrity versus someone that came there with their own agenda. And maybe that the whole purpose was to get a bunch of attention rather than doing something what we think which may be more strategic, which is flexing this community power for a collectively agreed upon end goal.
A listener writes in, on the Debug website, there's such a variety of content, everything from stories about the homeless grappling with winter to a barber battle. How does cultural coverage fit into Debug's mission and who produces it?
Well, it's fundamental. And I think maybe that's why we've been able to generate content over the years from what would otherwise be thought of as improbable sources. You know, our general kind of ethic with publishing is people most directly impacted by an issue or central to an issue should be the ones articulating what it's about. And so we hold weekly meetings. They're open meetings. They happen when we didn't have an office. And anyone off the street would come in and we ask what is of interest to them and what their reflections are on the news issues of the day. And, you know, there's a saying Indian philosopher said years ago that we use all the time. Krishnamurti said, you can't get wet talking about water. That sometimes the only way you understand that truth is by experiencing it. And so we are sort of giving the publishing rights to someone that's experienced an issue. So culture certainly plays a big role in why our media, I think, is read.
How did you get where you are? I actually tried to find a bio for you on your website. Didn't find one. Sort of poked around, and the best I could get was that you went to UCLA. So that's sort of all I know about Raj Jayadev's personal history. What shaped you? What brought you to doing what you're doing?
Well, in no means could I say that this was ever planned or this was ever intentional. Really, I sort of fell into Debug by what I saw initially in the first step of Debug when it wasn't an organization, by the people I met, by the inspirations that I was given, and by mentors. You know, I should say, too, the only reason why we're doing anything loosely affiliated with the concept of media is because of a sit-down I had with Sandy Close, the director of New America Media, that incubated us as an organization and has continued to be a lifetime mentor for me on, hey, here's another avenue of what's possible. And we sort of created our own lane from that. So it's been a learning process since we started. I think we've been influenced. You know, I sort of define ourselves less in a political framework or an activist framework or even a journalism framework. When people ask me what Debug is or where my sort of lens is coming from for it, I think of what Buddha said in the term of what requires for liberation. And he said, you need the eyes to see the path. And I saw that as vision and legs to walk the path. I saw that as action. But he said you also need the Sangha, which is a Pali word that doesn't exist anymore. But a Sangha was a community of practitioners all seeking their own liberation. And that's what we've become, I think, is a 2013 San Jose-based diverse Sangha.
Hmm. Let's take a call. Jack joins us in Petaluma. Jack, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. First time caller. Couldn't resist doing it, however, when I the topic of sentencing and giving the decision maker additional information about the defendant. I turned the show on late, so I assume you're talking about the Proposition 36 sentencing panels that are reviewing cases.
That's right.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Uh huh.
Yeah.
And you're a retired judge, is that right,
yeah,
Jack?
That's right. I'm coming. Same idea in the sense that here's the principle. Criminal cases, 90% of them are pleas to some plea. The prosecutor charges multiple charges. The public defender or the appointed attorney, who, again, represents probably 90% of the cases, look to get a deal to reduce it to the minimum amount. And the case is really about what the sentence is going to be. And I can assure you that two things. One, as a judge, I am looking in my decision-making amongst a number of things, one of which is what type of support will the person have. Many of the people that appear before judges come from families and backgrounds that don't have a lot of support. It's not that it's not there, but it has to be looked at a little deeper. The public defender or the appointed counsel who's underpaid and doesn't have the time to do it or won't do it, presents a very minimal case, even with good probation departments that present pre-sentence investigation reports. So anything that gives the judge more information and more ability to make a decision that might involve direct probation or at least less of a sentence is needed in this country. The last comment I'd make is that in terms of money, in addition to putting more public defenders and paying appointed attorneys more, what we do need is, in fact, more money going into probation departments and people who are able to do the type of work that this gentleman is talking about. And by the way, I applaud you for what you're doing. It's very, very important.
Jack, thank you. Thanks for the call. It's interesting about Jack's view about how needed these sorts of resources are as a retired judge. What's been the take from judges that you've talked to? What's been the view from the other side, from the DA's office?
Well, the comments that we've been receiving back, and who knows what they're saying in closed doors when they're not communicating with us, but is that it's been helpful pieces of information. And that's really all it's supposed to be. You know, we're not trying to make Hollywood blockbusters or make anyone cry. We're just trying to give you another point of reference. And so the district attorney's office, their role is not explicitly supposed to be to put someone away as long as possible. Their role explicitly is supposed to be seeking justice, and the same with judges. And so this should give them another avenue to do it. And I think Jack's point speaks to a bigger issue, too, when he says that most of these cases are pleas. And that's a problem because it is very different than what the public imagination is of what the American court system, how it operates, that there's this perception of everyone has their day in court. The truth of the matter is that the deck is so stacked, indigent defense is so under-resourced, sentencing mandates are dramatically changed the landscape of a sentencing outlook, that people are coerced and forced into pleas. We think there is a resource, though, that has been untapped, and that's the family and community organizing that I think could lend the political power to shift some of those numbers.
How do you choose your priorities? I mean, we talked at the beginning of the program about the diversity of work that Silicon Valley Debug does, from incubating new businesses to the journalism media work that you do to various social justice campaigns. What bubbles up to you? We spent the first part of our forum program this morning on the anniversary of the tragic shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, talking about gun violence in this country. How do you pick what to focus on? Would gun violence be something, for example, in San Jose, something that you would tackle, are tackling?
Yeah, absolutely. We're a group that creates our campaign agendas based on who's in the room and what their demands are, what they're calling for, and whether that's a response to a crisis, a tragedy, or trying to carve out new space of work that hasn't existed before, we're going to follow that intuition. And that's why, you know, I've always said that we're sort of the anti-organization, where usually in a group or organization or business or team, you put your individual goals or aspirations and baggage at the door for the good of the group. We do the opposite. We say you come in with all those aspirations, all that baggage, and then you lead us. Hmm. The reason why the social biography videos were particularly appealing to me is that it exampled a synergy of different sides of the organization, so they didn't have to be separate. We leveraged each other. So we had a bunch of families that come every Sunday to debug and say, I want to help tell the story of my loved one so I could get a better fair shake at the courts. Meanwhile, we had these young videographers that were making great media, cultural work, as one of the someone said earlier. So what if we leveraged the media chops of one side of the organization and had it collaborate with the organizing sensibility of the families?
It sounds very anti-hierarchical. I mean, if you think of most organizations or even most newsrooms, if you want to use a journalistic parallel, you know, there's a news director, there's an assignment editor who says, reporter Joe, you go cover X today. Doesn't sound like it works that way at Silicon Valley Debug.
No, we've been very dedicated to try to create a new way a group can operate, at least for our experiences, which was going to be horizontal and flat and allow leadership to evolve and erupt from unknown places.
And almost familial. I mean, in one of the videos I looked at, I saw you in the background bottle feeding your baby. So, I mean, it's a lot's happening there that makes it almost more like kind of, you know, from my time, a sort of 60s, 70s collective.
Yeah, it's absolutely a collective. That's probably the word we're most akin to. Look, my kid is raised at Debug, and he's going to have a richer experience growing up as a result. Same with the other children at Debug. They all have a bunch of honorary aunties and uncles. And there's a grander story there that people are learning to walk in connection and collaboration with all kinds of different people's lives. And I'm not saying, too, just to make it not at all seem glorious, this sort of more democratic style of decision-making isn't necessarily efficient. But efficiency has never been our goal. We've been sort of had a longer arc in our ambitions.
Victoria writes, love what this organization is doing. Very impressive. Has Raj considered putting together a training program that passes on these same tools in order to model this exact kind of debugging in other communities that are in dire straits? I'm all ears. How do we start?
Well, it's funny. You know, people used to ask us back in the day, can you scale it? Can you replicate it? And I'd never understood the question. You know, I was like, well, we're not McDonald's. We're not going to franchise this thing. But we are starting to try to share at least some of the values underneath it that a lot of people believe in. But it's difficult to make it go from a bumper sticker on the back of your car into a lived experience every day. And it's a challenge. We certainly want to share it. We think there's groups that are already doing this with a different name. For sure, we are trying to share the social biography video model with organizations, families, and public defender offices because we think it could transform the court process altogether.
But how is it going to be long-term sustaining? I mean, that's always the question with anything that is largely foundation supported, albeit I know you have some products that you can net earned income from. What do you do if the foundation goes away? What do you do if New America Media goes away? How do you make sure that this organization has a future?
Well, look, we're going to be a family whether we have an office or not. And we're going to be sharing stories whether we have a magazine or not. Hmm. And that's why, you know, our you asked earlier what our priority was. Our priority is on the integrity of our group, the relationships in our group. And that's why it's, you know, look, we're going to try to get support and keep our lights on just like any other group. And we're going to find innovative ways to do it. You know, we're fortunate enough to have an extremely talented group of people that first came to us because they wanted to try something and now are proficient and are professional. And, you know, they can make art, they can make video, they have new lanes of employment opportunities that could grow the organization. So I'm actually less worried about that than I think a lot of other organizations are.
How did you get to be so wise? I mean, you're a guy probably half my age, and you sound like you've figured a lot of things out.
No, not by any means. I think I just had a lot of coffee this morning. I in some ways, and this is probably what made me need fuller explanation, but I consider us a faith-based organization. We believe in each other, and we believe in the brilliance of the everyday experience and the capacity of everyday people.
Ladaris wants to join us next in Palo Alto. Oh, sorry, I skipped Ladaris. I'll come back to you. Carlos in San Jose.
Yeah, I'd like to get involved. I've got a story that I think is very riveting that happened here in San Jose a couple years ago. It also involves the courts. And I'd like to get involved. Is it possible to talk to you? Where do you meet and that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely, Carlos. Hope we could connect. There's a couple things. You come by Debug, which is probably the best way to do it. I'm usually there 7 days a week. The address is 701 Lenzen Avenue. We could talk more. Really what we think is possible, though, is if, you know, folks have an issue, if everything, what we don't want to do is make an egocentric organization. So we're not thinking that Debug alone can change these major institutions. But if we equip other groups that already exist, you know, whoever Carlos is connected to, if they have the same kind of tools that we have, then we could really transform, I think, at least the court system and other public institutions as well.
Carlos, thank you. Good luck. Joining us next, Ladaris joins us in Palo Alto.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I'm a retired Superior Court judge and who presided in Santa Clara County. And
is this Ladaris Cordell?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, Judge.
Yes.
How are you?
Hi. Good. And hi, Raj.
Hi, Judge.
I'm calling one to say, to give kudos to Silicon Valley Debug. And I just it's too bad that when I was on the bench that there was not such an organization, because what Silicon Valley Debug does is hold the courts accountable and everybody involved in it. That's my comment, and I have a question for Raj, and I've been asked this by other people as well. Who is Raj? Where do you come from such that you have this kind of commitment? So I'm very curious about your background.
Thanks, Judge. first of all, it's great hearing her voice. She's been tremendous for a lot of people in our community around the possibilities of justice now in her new role as independent police auditor. I really think I'm a construction of Debug to some degree. I know that seems – I don't know if that seems not enough. But I was telling Irene earlier
– Our producer. Your producer
– that's really some of the most significant lessons I've learned that I'm going to use to raise my kid have happened through moments at Debug. Both tough lessons and both triumphs. So I'm kind of going with it. I don't see myself as a deeply embattled, committed person. You know, when I hear people talk about burnout and exhaustion, or needing retreats and stuff, fellowships away from the work, it's a bit of a different orientation for me. I get to work around creative people every day, have fun every day, and learn something every day. So I guess I have a different orientation of what constitutes the work.
So no shout out to UCLA, no tip of the cap to your parents. I mean, what else was?
Yeah, you know what I tell what I do. What I tell my joke with my dad and my family back home in India is I'm more Indian than you ever wanted me to be.
What's that mean?
Well, you know, I think a lot of my construction of the world comes from my understanding of philosophies that came out of that mm-hmm. place and time. And my father certainly imbued that in me when I was young, and he probably is kicking himself now, but I try to use that in my lived experience.
Let's go to Lorna next in San Francisco. Oh, sorry, Lorna. I jumped away from you. I'll come back, promise. Kristen, go ahead, please.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was raised in Berkeley. I was born into a very politically activist family. I understand a lot of issues, and I just had a personal experience of I'm a mother of a daughter, an 18-year-old daughter in recovery from drug addiction, and I had to figure out the system really fast and try to get treatment, and I don't have a lot of funds, so that was challenging. She was part of the Healthy Families program that was eliminated now, and we're trying to navigate Medi-Cal. But
Kristen, I'm so sorry. We're just
okay,
real short on time.
Website,
yeah.
Where I would love for you guys to sort of address addiction and criminal justice and how it's all connected and how many people are locked up for crimes related to drugs.
Kristen, thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it speaks to the inefficiencies in the system where there's this mandated sentence around something that should be treatment rather than criminalization. We need political power to make that shift. Judges aren't going to do it by themselves. And I think if folks like the caller and their loved ones apply that pressure, we can make that change.
Lorna, you're next. And just briefly, I'm afraid, please.
Hi. Just wanted to say thank you so much for the work you're doing. And I work with nonprofits for the last 40 years, but this is micro-minding at its finest. And your generation is actually the largest volunteer generation in history. And you're bringing people's minds together that it's sort of like that universal component. It's invisible but extremely powerful and gathered as a collective. Just to leave you with the thought that Einstein said, all matter is thought vibrating at a certain frequency, and you are definitely vibrating at a great frequency. Just thank you for your work.
Thank you, Lorna. Thanks for the call. So you're about to drive back down the highway, 101 or 280 to San Jose, walking into who knows what. What do you want to have happen today?
Well, I'm going to come back today, and I'm going to celebrate one of our young people's releasing a CD yesterday. We had an event party, so the cultural work always energizes. There's going to be a strategic planning, I think, at least in the back of my mind. We had 4 homeless people die in San Jose last week from hypothermia in the richest area to live in the country. So I'm going to carry a lot of that healthy tension with me. And my son's going to be there playing probably on the computer.
Raj Jayadev, the founder, executive director of Silicon Valley Debug. Great pleasure to have you on our program today. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.